Hunt's shock at seeing his former captor forces Bryce to step in to do what she does best, distract. After catching the attention of Micah, Bryce dismisses the governor's advances, causing him to lash out at Hunt. In an effort to find whoever's behind the missing horn, Hunt visits the Oracle, where he is warned to stay away from Bryce. The warning only brings Bryce and Hunt closer together as they prepare to finally see Briggs in person. The meeting does not go according to plan, and only Bryce is able to help Hunt get out of his head and his spiral of self-hatred. A quick meeting with Rune and his friends has Bryce showing off her firearm skills for Hunt, where things get tense and heated.
The views expressed by the hosts are entirely their own and in no way represent the thoughts or intentions of the original author.
This podcast is a discussion, shared to spark thought and conversation on the characters and themes of this novel.
The interpretations presented in this podcast are just a few of the many possibilities. Listeners are encouraged to read along and share their own analysis of the text.
Though the hosts speak mostly within the constraints of this book, series and extended universe spoilers may be discussed with or without warning.
Explicit language, as well as themes of sex, violence, abuse, depression, self-harm, and death will recur throughout this podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
This is part one of this week's episode. Stick around for part two, which releases on Thursday.
Welcome to Book Talk for Book Talk, a podcast where we deep dive into the writing of your favorite novels.
This season, we're exploring Sarah J. Maas's first installment in the Crescent City series.
This is Jack.
And I'm Amy.
This week, we're discussing chapters 31 through 37 in A House of Earth and Blood.
The question we're asking ourselves this week is there a difference between love and loyalty for these characters?
The theme we'll see in this section is vulnerability.
Chapter 31 picks up with Sandriel and Micah on one end of the Comitium and Bryce and Hunt on the other, and it's a shit show. In this moment, Sandriel has power over both Bryce and Hunt because of her notoriety. Hunt has a personal knowledge of Sandriel, and he's frozen in place by his memories of the torture he endured under Sandriel's hand. On the flip side, though Bryce does not have this personal knowledge, she is frozen in place because of, one, the power radiating from the archangel, and also media.
And the governor.
Yeah. It's true. And just Sandriel's notoriety through media. And I just thought that was interesting that both are similarly caught off guard, even though their experiences are completely different. Bryce, in that moment, has to take back as much power as she can to free herself and Hunt from that situation, even if that power she's taking is a complete facade.
It's so weird to think that they're all celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's so weird.
Like, one time I was in a hotel and I saw Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
Uh-huh.
So hot. But it's like, imagine being like, oh, there's an archangel who tortured so many people.
Wow.
Right? It's so weird.
Being starstruck.
Yeah. It is strange that like they're all celebrities and Bryce isn't no one.
Yeah. Yeah.
As far as they know.
Right.
So SJM's description of Hunt, I really love the word choice she has here. Quote, a step ahead. Hunt was a trembling live wire. And I love the description of a trembling live wire and just the contradiction of the two. Because trembling obviously indicates some form of weakness, right? Mm-hmm. Like you're just shaking. Mm-hmm. And a live wire is a live wire. It's an electrocution wire where, like, you know, you don't want to touch it. Otherwise, you'll be electrocuted, which is, like, again, perfect for Hunt.
Yeah, because of his lightning.
Yeah.
It also makes me think of, like, a downed power line, how it's lashing out back and forth, and you don't know where it's going to hit.
Exactly.
And I could see Hunt being that right now.
I mean, you don't know what he's going to do. He's not bowing. He's like, are you going to try to kill her right now? Like, what are we doing here, Hunt? What's the long game? And we're going to see later on, I feel like, a similar-ish description of Bryce. As I wrote my note later, I was like, you're reaching, Jack. But I feel like I'll build it up by then.
Okay. I am trembling with anticipation.
Bryce diffuses the situation by playing her role, the party girl. Quote, Bryce stepped closer to his side, flicking her ponytail over a shoulder. She took her brand new phone out of her pocket, making sure the sound was cranked up so everyone could hear the loud click, click, click as she snapped photos of the two archangels, then turned, angling herself and the phone to get a shot of herself and the governors in the background. But first, let me take a selfie, is the definition of Bryce in this moment. And it is shocking, it's unexpected, but most importantly, it's excused. Because Bryce is a woman. Mm. Bryce is a party girl. And once again, she is weaponizing this feminine, aloof, airy party girl. Like, I'm just here for the pics.
Yeah.
And again, which is funny, because if anyone actually knew Bryce, like, she wouldn't give a fuck about taking a photo of anyone.
But her personality is like, do it for the gram.
Right. And it's such a thing that only women can get away with.
Yeah.
Like, you never see a guy... I don't want to say never, but none that I can imagine. I'd be like, wait, hold on. Let me take a selfie real fast.
And if they did, we would mock them.
Yeah, I'd be like, what are you doing? Yeah. Why are we taking a selfie?
Yeah.
Stop it. And this is also the first time that the feminine is protecting Hunt.
Mm-hmm.
It's in his defense. And Hunt has to accept that her party girl ways, that persona, her feminine is his protector now. And by the end of the episode, I'm going to say that he's accepted it.
I think so, too. I think this is a turning point for him.
Yes.
And we're going to see the whole narrative around these two change throughout mm-hmm. the course of this episode, which I'm really excited about.
Very.
To take back control of the situation, Micah confronts Bryce and Hunt. And in that moment, Bryce is trying to remind herself why she's not afraid of Micah, because, again, the power radiating off of Micah and Sandriel is overwhelming, and mm-hmm. her instinct is to be afraid. Bryce thinks, quote, too fucking bad that Micah was about as warm as a fish at the bottom of a mountain lake. Too fucking bad he used Hunt like a weapon, dangling his freedom like a dog treat. On one hand, in this description, Bryce is recognizing that Micah uses his position of power to reduce Hunt to a weapon or a dog, just beneath him, basically. On the other hand, though, in this same moment, Bryce is reducing Micah to prey that is capable of being devoured as well, a fish. She sees him for what he is, slippery, slimy, mm-hmm. not something for her to truly be afraid of. And I think this moment of her reducing him helps her in the future be able to face him and not be overwhelmed by her fear for him.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when you think about the first time, because this is only the second time she's seen him in person, right?
Right.
And the first time was, I mean, not in the alley, but the first time was he came to the gallery. Mm-hmm. She was freaking out and she was like, oh my God, I had posters of him in my room. He is so hot. I'm so scared.
Yeah.
And even though Bryce is referencing like the reasons why she no longer respects him, essentially, mm-hmm. she's saying it's because of Hunt. What I'm wondering is the thing that she's not saying, and that's the fact that she saved him. How much is his mystique, his power, his danger of, like, being the governor kind of disappear when it's, like, she survived?
Yeah.
And he didn't, and she saved him.
Yeah. That's a great point. And it's curious that she is so overwhelmed by his presence that she can't even remember that in this moment.
But she's so overwhelmed with her disgust of him.
Yes.
It's like not even overwhelmed by his awe.
Yeah, yeah. You know, how built he is or whatever the case is.
It's more of like a, oh, you're a douche.
Yeah.
I'm not even going to like remember that time I saved you. Mm-hmm. Which like, it's almost like imagining that's like you have a life. You have a life debt now.
Yep.
So you owe me.
That's right.
Bryce sees Micah checking her out. He is looking her up and down, and Bryce immediately knows the look that's on his face. The moment where he just is like, you, I'm gonna do you. And because Micah sees how hot Bryce is and assumes that she's gonna fall for him. Mm-hmm. Like, he can do whatever and get whatever. Have you looked up fan art of Micah?
No.
He is.
I don't need to feel problematic feelings.
If it helps, he's blonde.
Yeah, I knew that.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, like, to, like, put it off.
No, I like blonde boys.
I know, but not, like, the good kind of blonde boys. Okay, there's, like, a category of, like, the good
silver
blonde.
Silver blondes.
Yep. The Witcher. Blonde. Malfoy.
Yeah.
House of Dragons.
Yeah, I like the silver blonde over the golden blonde.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mike is a golden blonde?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair.
But what I think is that Micah is using sex as a weapon. I don't want to say I don't think he's interested in her because Bryce is hot.
Right.
But I don't, I'm not entirely convinced that like he would normally go for her.
Yeah.
If there wasn't such a, you know, a bunch of things happening with the power, right? Like she chose to walk off with Hunt.
Yeah.
After taking the photos, and Hunt was disrespectful.
Yeah.
So he probably comes in and is like, I'm going to sweep her right from underneath you.
Right.
You know, he did the whole looking up and down, but again, like, not entirely convinced that it's like a I'm purely attracted to you situation. And what I also love is that it's kind of like the battle of sexual attraction. Mm-hmm. I think Bryce kind of looks at this moment and was like, excuse me, this is my weapon. I'm the one who uses sex.
Yeah. Yeah.
As
how
a weapon.
Dare you yeah, take like, my weapon?
You're doing this. When I worked at a frozen yogurt shop in Scottsdale, you remember that one? Mm-hmm. I got tons of spring training baseball players who came in.
I remember this. Yeah.
Yeah. And one came in and like they're worth millions of dollars. The baseball players were the worst. And they would come in and be like, this one guy was like, hey, can I have that for free? And he gave me the most charming smile. And I was like, I use that smile. I use that smile for free shit.
You're not allowed to.
You can't use that on me. And then there's no reason for this quote, but I just love it. Boo fucking who?
SJM's narrative in this book is just so funny.
Yeah.
And I'm going to bring that up again later, too. It is written for the millennials and the Gen Z, and I really, really love it.
Yep.
So after Bryce turns down Micah, they close the elevator. Hunt and Bryce are trying to escape from the Comitium. And there's a moment where Hunt observes that Bryce, quote, twirled the silken length of her ponytail around a wrist, unaware that she bared the golden column of her throat to him with the movement. Now, given what we know of Bryce, she's always hyper aware of her safety and how she comes across and trying to make sure that she never is viewed as prey. And if she is viewed as prey, making sure she's defensive about it. But in this elevator scene, you know, she's just faced off with Micah. And it's interesting the shift we're seeing that she's allowing herself to expose her throat to Hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a sign of vulnerability, physical vulnerability. And either she's too dazed to notice or she's like, Hunt's not that bad compared to Micah. I can trust him with my throat.
Yeah, yeah.
Compared to Micah, who would definitely take a bite out of it.
It's symbolic and Hunt would notice.
Oh, yeah. Hunt definitely would notice.
Which he did.
Right.
We're reading it.
And from his, it's coming from his point of view. And on one hand, we could choose to see this as a predator thing, seeing an opportunity for attack. But instead, it comes across as very sexual.
I also just like spent so long trying to twirl my hair around my wrist.
Her hair must be fucking long.
I have long hair and I'm mad. Like I'm twirling it. I can't
Your
even
hair
say I
is
twirled
long.
It. Yeah.
Her hair has to be down to her waist or longer.
God, just when I thought I had long hair, fucking Bryce comes in and is like, more rosemary water, please. We're also seeing this ponytail being used as a weapon and the fact that she keeps tossing around, hitting people. Like this ponytail is a guest star in this chapter.
It really, really is.
It's so freaking funny. And now she's holding it back from Hunt. Like you said, she's baring her throat to him. And it's, you can almost like look at it as like she's tamed the weapon.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
This ponytail was flipping and flapping.
Right. It almost hit Hunt in the face at some point.
Mm-hmm. Multiple points, I think. And she's tamed that in that moment while they're having their private time. And Micah tried to get her to be compliant and she fought back. Hunt hasn't like asked anything at this moment. Like he'll ask her later, like, you sure? You don't want to do anything? But she's showing him her weakness because he was weak.
And we're going to see a lot of that this episode.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like one of the themes is vulnerability.
Oh my.
Or the theme.
When they get to the landing platform where Hunt and Bryce are going to fly back to her apartment, Bryce is not about the flying because she hasn't, you know, been carried by Hunt up until this point. You can tell she's afraid. And Hunt is expressing his gratitude to her. And I found this to be an interesting time for him to choose to be grateful. I'm glad he's expressing his gratitude, but it's also serving as a distraction. And I wonder if that cuts into the sincerity of his gratitude.
Right? Where it's like, I'm so grateful. She's like, I don't want to die.
Yeah,
it's so high.
Exactly. So Hunt is thanking Bryce for bailing him out of the situation with Mike and Sandriel, all while he's bending to pick her up. She's wincing. She's strangling him with her hands because she's afraid of heights. And they're about to take off and fly over the city. I wonder if in this moment, although Hunt is, again, I think sincerely grateful, he's also trying to take control of this situation. Like, mm-hmm. this is something I can do. Mm-hmm. This is my way of protecting you now.
Yeah.
This is my power. So let me do the thing you're afraid of, and we're just going to go off into the air.
He's like, Princess carrying her away.
Ugh, goals.
Right? I'm also happy he didn't tell her that she was heavy mid-flight.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, oh.
And, like, I'm happy he came to that realization while she was unconscious or, like, in shock.
Yeah, yeah.
Last time. So the flight, I think, is also really important because of how different this physical contact is. Like I kind of hinted, the last time he carried her, she was in shock. Mm-hmm. And I think he was in shock, too. Like, they just went through the whole bombing at the White Raven. This time, they are both super aware that he's carrying her.
Yeah.
You know, we're getting the description of him putting his arm underneath her legs mm-hmm. and behind her back. She's wrapping her arms around him. And they're up in the sky. And it's forced vulnerability.
Yeah.
It's forced intimacy.
Forced proximity.
Yeah. Because even like some of the way that the language that SJM uses, because she knows how to tease and draw it out. You know, he asks her like, do you not want to look down? And she says, absolutely not. And then it's like, he chuckles in her ear. I'm like, oh, in her ear.
Oh my, so close.
That's like an orifice. Chuckling into any part, any hole in your body is...
You know, honestly, this set of chapters, everyone talks about Hunt's fetish with feet. I think he has a fetish for ears.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? It's like he's really into her ear.
He's
but you know
really
what?
Into her ears.
Out of like all of the weirdest body parts, ears are the sexiest.
Yeah. They're equally as dirty as feet sometimes.
Yeah. And I'm throwing elbows into this. Just talking
kneecaps.
About the, yeah, you know, the weird parts.
Great. While flying over the city, Hunt is looking out at Lunafian, and he thinks of Pangera in comparison. Quote, the cities were little more than pens for the Vanir to trap and feed on humans and their children. No wonder the humans had risen up. I point this out because Hunt is feeling empathy for humans in this moment, because he too was once a slave in a pen. I think that's an important foundation for as we dive into this episode and we meet Briggs for the first time, because I don't think we've seen a lot of empathy from Hunt for humans, and that's all going to change very rapidly.
I have a note on that later.
Oh, yay.
Yeah. As Hunt and Bryce are still in the air, Hunt sees... Quote, the sunlight glowed off of the white stones of Luna's temple, and, as if in a mirror reflection, directly across from it, seemed to be absorbed by the black-domed Oracle's temple, his destination tomorrow morning. I've made a case before in the past that I feel like Bryce is metaphorically Luna. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that she's actually Luna, unless that's what happens. I think in this moment, Hunt sees himself as the dark temple, and Bryce is that light temple. Hunt, we have to remember, he's in a funky place right now. He's, you know, trying to get his head straight. And Bryce was his light in that moment. He was the save. She was the saving grace. And I think that this is him almost thinking like, I'm absorbing her light. I'm so depressed. I'm in such a dark space that I'm just taking her joy and ruining it.
I like that.
Thank you. Especially when he's like, that's my destination tomorrow. I think it's almost like an extra... Yep, that's me.
Yeah, yeah. An extra, like, tying those two threads together of these two things are associated.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Thank you. When Hunt asks Bryce about her rejection of Micah, she says, quote, so, just because I saved his life doesn't mean I'm destined to be his girlfriend. It'd be like banging a statue anyway. And I love it because her reason isn't, I'm trying, like, okay, let me see if I can describe it. So Hunt is saying, hey, don't you want to sleep with him? And she's saying, just because I saved his life, not just because he's super powerful and hot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's such a, it's such an interesting moment where if I was like, if you were to be like, hey, Jack, don't you want to sleep with Theo James? The obvious answer is yes. But you would think, be like, no, just because he's hot. Just because I saved his life. Like, I was like, no one made that connection. Like, just, you know, if I've saved people's life, I don't think I deserve to have sex with them.
Yeah, but I would say in some ways, SJM's making fun of herself. Think about Aelin and Feyre and the individuals who have saved their lives.
Mm-hmm.
I would say at least 75% of the time they slept with them.
Yeah, that's fair. I should save more lives.
I think that Bryce is a vehicle for SJM not only to make fun of herself and the tropes that she's created, often used,
yeah,
but also calling attention to the fact that we don't have to obey these tropes.
Yeah. I'm going to do a really long quote because I feel like this quote is important. It's entirely different than what we've seen from SJM, which are really young women who get mated up really soon.
Yeah.
Not that Bryce isn't young. She's 25, but in still comparison, yeah. When Bryce says, quote, "See, that right there is the problem. You and the whole rest of the world seem to think I exist just to find someone like him. That, of course, I can't be genuinely not interested. Because why wouldn't I want a big, strong male to protect me? Surely if I'm pretty and single, the second any powerful veneer shows interest, I'm bound to drop my panties. In fact, I didn't even have a life until he showed up. Never had sex, never felt alive. Dark hell, this woman." So again, it's a long quote, but it's just so important, not just for characters, but I think for readers.
Yeah.
You know, I think that this is SJM being really aware that her majority of her readers are young women.
Yeah.
Or just women in general.
Yeah.
And kind of, you know, having this message of like, hey, look, I recognize it. In the past, her other characters were just like, you're the most beautiful man I've ever seen.
Okay.
Mate me. And like, you know, I'm not here to say that I would do otherwise. Yeah. But it's, you know, Bryce is different.
Bryce is different. And what I love about this is I feel like in this monologue, Bryce is calling out her society, but also ours.
Yeah.
Calling out our patriarchy and how women are viewed in our society.
Mm-hmm.
And how sometimes women treat other women. Like, of course he's hot. So of course you would want to be with him. Like, no, maybe I want a career.
Right? Or of course he's powerful. Why wouldn't you want to be with that person? Like, it's almost an assumption / justification.
Right.
What's also super meaningful in this monologue is that these are things that Bryce has been saying this entire book.
Yeah.
We are 300 and something pages in.
Yep.
And this is not anything new, but I think this is the first time Hunt hears her.
Yeah.
Which is why I believe he goes the extra mile to demonstrate he's not an alpha hole.
I agree, because he's like, okay, well, I don't have to be these things for her to notice me. And he's not actively thinking that, but I think he's subconsciously thinking that.
Mm-hmm.
I also love in this moment, we're seeing Bryce's reaction from Hunt's point of view in this dialogue. SJM just does the best thing. And Jack previously talked about the ponytail being a weapon, but now it has personality.
Yeah.
Now it's sentient and it's comedic and unique to Hunt. And it's what makes his point of view fun to read and differentiates him from Bryce's point of view. And it's just good writing.
Yeah.
Quote, Hunt crossed his arms. She crossed hers. That stupid fucking ponytail seemed to cross its proverbial arms, too. And it's just chef's kiss.
It's so freaking funny. Like, you know, minus the obviously weapon on weapon, you know, crossing their arms there.
Right, right, right.
But it also gives me confidence to let, you know, let your ponytail fly free, ladies.
Let it have its own life.
Personality. Yeah. I've walked and been like, oh, my hair's swishing too much. Got a comment. No.
Let it do its thing.
Let it do its thing.
We then end chapter 31 and move into chapter 32. Remember how in episode 1, I talked about Bryce treasuring Danica, and that was demonstrated in Bryce's description of the color of Danica's hair. She specifically called the color amethyst, sapphire, and rose. Well, in chapter 32, as the sun is setting, Hunt notices when Bryce smiles, quote, her eyes crinkled with amusement, the last of the day's sunlight lighting them into liquid gold. And to me, this is a clear indication in the narrative style that Hunt's affection for Bryce is growing because he's starting to describe her differently than before.
The attraction between the two is going up, you know, like we've been saying that the last couple of episodes, but like it's really happening, guys.
Yeah, it's really happening.
And while Bryce doesn't want an alpha hole, she's super attracted to his guyness. And, you know, like Hunt watches sports. He wears a backwards baseball cap and she is into it. And little spoiler for book two, not a huge spoiler, but like tiny little one. At one point, she says something like, he was wearing that backward baseball cap again. I can't like that's sexy. Yeah. Like can't handle that. And, you know, there's a difference between alpha holes and guys. But is there really, or is it just Hunt? You know what I mean? Like, no. You know, it's funny where she's like, fuck these alpha got holes. But it's like, you're such a boy. Yes.
Yeah. I think she's starting to see beyond his facade, right? Mm-hmm. Just like he's starting to see beyond her facade. The alpha hole facade for Hunt is equivalent to Bryce's vapidness.
Yep. Good point. Really good point. I was re-listening to House of Sky and Breath recently, and I did think that pretty often of like, God, he really is so different than other characters that we've seen from SJM. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it makes me think of Throne of Glass characters mm-hmm. and ACOTAR men. And it's like, he really isn't that alpha hole-ish. Like, right. I'm not saying he's not an alpha, but Bryce is the alpha in that relationship.
Right, right. His alpha succeeds to her alpha.
Yeah.
Just as things are getting good, someone's got to ruin the moment because this book and SJM are all about the slow burn. She was like, can I write a slow burn? And she said, yes, I can write a slow burn.
So slow, you won't get anything until book two.
Basically. As a result, Micah calls and demands Hunt's services as retribution for the slight Hunt performed that basically Hunt not bowing, Hunt disobeying at the Comitium has resulted in this. Micah is saying, I need you to do some killing. Quote, Micah would give him this warning and make him do this job tonight to remind him where the fuck he stood in the pecking order, and then that would be that. Micah even forces Hunt to pick up the file of the person he's to assassinate in Hunt's room at the barracks. And as I was thinking about this, Hunt's room at the barracks is the sanctum of the Umbra Mortis, not Hunt. Mm-hmm. Hunt himself spends as little time as possible in his room at the barracks, at least from our vantage point as readers. To me, this is him trying to keep his distance from the Umbra Mortis facade and who he has to be when he becomes the Umbra Mortis. And I think we're going to see that demonstrated when he actually does the assassination as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And why is Micah doing this? And I think this is, you know, a really good call out is that this is coming from Hunt's point of view. When he gets the call from Micah, it's like, oh, I didn't bow. I was being disrespectful. This is him reminding me of the pecking order. I feel like if we got Bryce's point of view, and again, I feel like this is what we can infer, the main reason why Micah's doing this is because Bryce rejected Micah. Mm-hmm. And Bryce decided to walk away with Hunt. I don't think it has much to do, you know, sure, not bowing, Sandril, all that stuff. But really, Bryce walked away with Hunt, and for the first time, Micah was rejected. And I love that we're not picking this up from Hunt.
Yeah.
He's taking the blame.
Yeah.
Had this been from Bryce's point of view, I think she would see exactly what it is, why Micah's doing this. But as readers, that's what we can infer.
I love that you pointed that out, because it is, in some ways, Micah being like, well, fuck you, Bryce. I'm going to take away your company tonight.
Exactly.
Now you can be alone.
He hurt both of them in this move.
Because that's what Micah does.
Yeah.
So we then get to the point in the chapter where Hunt performs his service to Micah, aka he's assassinating a cougar shifter. And in this moment, we see a shift in the narrative style. It's distancing, it's dehumanizing in the way we understand dehumanizing, not because
he's
Hunt
not
is human.
Human.
Yeah. Let me read this quote. Every utterance dragged Hunt further away, until the arm he outstretched was distant, until the gun he aimed at the male's head was just a bit of metal. The male had done horrible things, unspeakable things. He deserved this, deserved worse. Hunt was nothing but a shadow, a wisp of life, an instrument of death. He was nothing and no one at all. Hunt, in his own mind, reduces himself to an object. He loses his identity. Just like Bryce previously accused Micah of doing, it's mm-hmm. become almost a prophecy. And we see in this moment also Hunt dehumanizing the victim to help him justify his actions. And it's a funny parallel, because is that not what Bryce did to Micah at the Comitium? It's the same thing, but in a less positive way.
Yeah. I'm sorry, listener. We talked about not wanting to bring in comparisons to other SJM characters. But again, I just feel like it's so important to point out how different Hunt is compared to what SJM has written before.
Yeah.
And I was listening to Silver Flames. So, like, slight Silver Flame spoiler there. But Cassian talks to Nesta about how he went to the village that his mother, like, lived in, where he was born, and killed every single person, every single man there. Let the women and children live, but killed every single man there. And how Reese and Asriel, quote, shredded his father in front of him. Mm-hmm. There was no guilt or remorse there.
Yeah.
And how many, and he even said, like, some of the men, they didn't do anything, but they watched what happened to her.
Yeah.
And Hunt says that this shifter deserved it, that he did horrible things. Micah could have easily had sent him to a pure innocent. And I'm not defending Micah here, but, like, it is so different compared to other SJM males, where they're like, I think other characters could have defended it, being like, I don't like them being forced to do this, but, like, you are a piece of shit, so fuck you.
Right. Well, think about Reese in Wings and Ruin when he tears apart the ravens in the library.
Yep.
He does it with his hands because he needed to feel their deaths.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they relish death in Prithian.
They do. And it does. You know, what's funny is, like, when we did the ACOTAR season, we were so, like,
ooh,
smiled. You guys aren't that bad. And now reading Hunt, I think that SJM for this book got a lot of crap of saying, like, this is just like her other books. Mm-hmm. This is a copy and paste.
And it is not.
It's so not. Hunt is so different. He's a sensitive boy.
He is a sensitive boy. And even though killing is what he's good at and what he's trained to do, it obviously eats away at his soul.
And all this is me being a really bad person. He's only using a gun.
Well, no, but that's, it's very impersonal.
And that's the thing. Like, yeah, it's very impersonal.
And it still eats away at him.
Yeah, like, Reese shredded the ravens with his hands.
Yeah. It just goes to show that Hunt is not a replica of Cassian or Reese. Mm-hmm. Hunt is his own character.
Or Rowan or anything. Right. Like, SJM truly made a unique leading male.
Yep. Yep, I agree. Which I did not think before doing the analysis.
Same.
I think it's important in this scene that we actually don't ever see the deaths that Hunt performs,
mm-hmm.
No, both in this scene and earlier scenes. The scenes almost always end with Hunt's act of killing, but never the consequences of the kill, right? Yeah. We very rarely, if ever, see the body.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if Hunt blacks out completely because he's disassociated so much and his body's on autopilot. Like, he just is like, I can't process this, so I'm not going to even give you that in the narrative.
Yeah. Sorry. Another thought that just popped in my mind of, like, this weird balance of Hunt and how we're seeing the real Hunt. If you think back to earlier in the book when Bryce was being questioned after the attack on Danica and Sabine was being a total bitch and then Hunt stares at her, Isaiah describes it as not many people survived after that, right? So he was totally capable of leaning into that, I can kill you at any moment.
Right.
If people only knew.
Right. Right. And that's the part of him he doesn't let people see.
Mm-hmm.
So we do see the consequences of the kill from Hunt's perspective once he gets back to the Comitium. Quote, so Hunt patched himself up, pieced himself together, half crawled out of the boiling hot shower and into the person he was when he wasn't forced to put a bullet between someone's eyes. And just a reminder, a scalding or boiling hot shower can be a form of self-harm. And in Hunt's case, the shower is both washing away the umbra mortis facade, but is also punishment for wearing the umbra mortis facade at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's why he takes that shower after every kill.
Yeah. Poor Hunt. I mean, ultimately, I think this goes back to my earlier description of Hunt seeing himself as the Black Dome.
Mm-hmm.
And he showers at the Comitium.
Yeah.
Not at Bryce's apartment.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't want her to see any part of it.
Right.
He doesn't want her light to be absorbed by him.
That's right. And I just wanted to point out, because this popped into my brain, SJM is notorious for the power of three, doing things three times. So this is the second time we've seen Hunt shower after a kill.
First
time was basically earlier in the book, early in part two, I think. And we're going to see another one in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And each time...
He breaks a little bit more.
We dwell a little bit more on the moment.
And Bryce patches him up a little bit more.
Yep. Just a cute little like, oh, moment. Bryce recorded the Sun Bowl game that Hunt wanted to watch because she knew he wanted to watch it. And it tightens Hunt's chest and it just tightens my chest too.
It's like what you were saying. She patches him up a little bit more.
Yeah.
Like this is the beginning patch. This is her being like, here you go.
Like, I can't undo what you just did.
But I can make it a little bit better.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can, instead of like rejecting him outright for doing what he did for Micah.
Yeah. We enter chapter 33 and Hunt is visiting the Oracle and it smells like crap there. Rather, it smells like sulfur. And if anyone smelled sulfur before, it smells like rotting eggs. That's what people describe it as. Mm-hmm. I can't tell if I've ever smelled sulfur before, if I just heard about it so much. I want to say I have. I want to say Arizona is sulfury.
It is. Well, think about the hot springs when we go to the hot springs.
Thank you.
There's a lot of sulfur.
You said it so confidently. And I was like, when have I ever smelled sulfur? Now, here's like just a fun fact and stuff. When I was like really into like my ghost hunting TV show days, a lot of them talked about when you smell sulfur, it's the scent of a demon nearby out of randomly. For me, it's very fitting for what's happening right now. I'm not saying that the Sphinx is a demon, but also like not.
Well, think about it. So like with the idea of hot springs, the water is coming from deep in the earth, which is why there's the scent of sulfur. And if we think hell is at the core of the earth for whatever reason, fire and brimstone.
Yeah.
Makes sense that we associate sulfur with demons.
Yeah.
I also wonder if the smoke that the Oracle looks through is coming from deep in the earth.
Mm.
That's why I always wrote off the sulfur stuff, because I was like, oh, it's just coming from deep in the earth. I don't know.
I'm going to edit this out. But it also, or no, I'm not going to edit this out. I'm going to say spoiler warning for book two. When we think about the mystics and how they talk to demons, I'm not saying that they're looking through sulfur, but it's going through the concept of like, in order to quote unquote see things, you have to integrate hell a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah.
When Hunt visits the Oracle, he's not over the fact that he just performed his assassination duties the night before. In fact, quote, after last night, what he'd done, a sacred temple was the last place he wanted to be, the last place he deserved to be. Hunt is punishing himself. And we're going to see that a lot over and over in these chapters, that he can't escape his own spiral right now. And it makes him a little wary. And I think that's important given how wary he is, not only of the Oracle, but of Bryce later on. Like, he's just so vulnerable right now that he can't make sense of anything.
Yeah.
That wariness is heightened when the Oracle actually appears.
Before you get into your quote and everything, he describes the Oracle as being like so beautiful he doesn't know what to do with himself.
Yeah.
Give me a medium ugly person once
in
this book. Everyone is so beautiful.
I feel
like I'm cute. I can wave my cute flag, especially when I like dress up and stuff. I would feel so intimidated being in this world.
Honestly, give me a plain Jane.
Right?
Just someone ordinary
looking. Like, wow. Hunt looked into the Oracle's rather simple face.
Exactly. She was nothing to look at.
Yeah, but I'm sure she had a lovely personality.
Yeah. So as Jack mentions, the Oracle is beguiling. Her presence in and itself is powerful because she is so beautiful. Her voice is powerful because it's so seductive. Even Hunt is aware that, quote, the words rumbled over his bones, luring him in. Not in the way he sometimes let himself be lured in by beautiful females, but in the manner that a spider might lure a fly to its web. It's curious that Hunt is cognizant of this, because usually when someone's so overcome by another person's beauty, they forget all reason. But Hunt is reasonable. He's like, no, this is a trap.
Yeah,
well, I need to be careful.
Also, like, isn't she in cat form? She has paws.
She is a lion's body with a human's face and wings.
Yeah, so isn't that bestiality?
basically.
I hope he's not interested in her.
Well, you know what? I think he wants to feel some control, so he's not going to be into her that much. Which is why he ultimately turns down the Oracle's offer to look into his future, and it really pisses me off. I would really love that clue.
Seriously. Rude. It's like he doesn't even know he's in a book.
Right.
Right. And we want clues. It just makes me think, you know, if we're in a simulation and someone's playing this game and they want clues of my future, make sure to communicate it. Like, yeah. What if we are in a book right now?
Oh, my.
Right? Also, like, the Oracle's like, hey, want to know more about Bryce? Want me to tell you about Bryce? What happened to Oracle patient confidentiality?
Obviously, there were no forms. Yeah. She has no legal team.
At the very beginning, Hunt's like, you're not going to tell anyone. She's like, never. This is between you, me, and the gods. Unless it's that bitch, Bryce. Then I will tell you everything about her.
Well, probably because the Oracle's like, she's cursed. She's of the devil. That's mm-hmm. why she's willing to
spill the beans. Willing
yeah, I guess
to be like,
so.
Like, talk about spill the tea.
Yeah.
You and I would be so bad at this place. Be like, do you want to know about your future? Yes.
Yes.
Do you want to know about Bryce, this other
yes.
person's thing? Yeah. Let me go grab the tea. You know, my nose will get used to the sulfur.
After visiting the Oracle, chapter 33 ends, and we move into chapter 34. And early on, there is a mention of Ophion and Kara's here. And I know we've talked kind of about Kara's before. That's Briggs's human rebel group located in Lunathian, whereas Ophion is the overall human rebel group that is, I think, specifically stationed in Pangera. I wanted to talk about the origin of Ophion, even though it's less relevant now than it is in Sky and Breath, but mm-hmm. I'll bring it back up in Sky and Breath
yeah.
when we get to that yeah. season.
Save, copy, paste.
So Ophion in Greek means serpent, and Ophion was actually one of the first gods to rule the world with his wife before being struck down into the ocean by the Titans Cronus and Rhea, all while Zeus was still a baby god for context. So Zeus mm-hmm. was not a full god at this point. Ophion is also a species of wasp. They are nocturnal, parasitic, and often seen at lights.
Seriously? Ew.
Yeah.
Here?
I don't remember the region.
California? Okay.
However, I just thought it was interesting, and there are interesting parallels between that description and Ophion in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to bring that up.
I love that. Bryce tells Hunt about seeing the Oracle the first time, right? Mm-hmm. And she talks a little bit about the Fae tradition and how girls go to see the Oracle when they start their period or when they turn 13, while boys go to see the Oracle at 13. And I always get so bothered when moments like these where it's like, basically it's like they go to the Oracle when it's quote unquote entering adulthood, right?
Yeah.
But girls, it can be when you start your period. And I started about to announce this to the world. I started my period when I was
11.
I was like a month before my 11th birthday.
Yeah.
I was like, I would have been like just shy of 11 going to the Oracle.
Yeah. Yeah. It's traumatizing.
Right? Versus like, and you don't hear that with boys of like, they're going to go see the Oracle when their voice changes.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So it's very annoying. And also like, once again, we see a part of their society mm-hmm. where time and tradition is measured around women's cycles.
Yeah. So knowing that SJM is Jewish, and I should have looked this up. I didn't think about it.
Bar mitzvahs?
Yeah, it made me think of bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs.
Yeah, I want to say that's just 13.
Yeah.
Not like, hey, you started your period.
Therefore, yeah.
Yeah, but I could be wrong.
I should have looked it up, and I didn't.
We're going to let our listeners email us.
I think in this moment when Bryce is talking about her experience with the Oracle, this is a moment of bonding between her and Hunt because of basically her trauma and how her father treated her. And I think we've said this before. I see a parallel between Feyre and Tamlin
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that they bond over shared trauma or similar experiences with trauma.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that Hunt had a traumatic experience with the Oracle, but it adds depth to Bryce's character, and I think Hunt empathizes with that.
Yeah. Bryce says, quote, I've never not been proud of it. being human. There's no good segue. I did that there. But do you feel like that's a true statement?
I don't know. If you think about earlier in the novel, it was really hard to tell when she favored her fae side versus her human side.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of unspoken comparisons between the two. And at first, sometimes she seemed to favor her human side. But then there are times where she's like, oh, I'm so glad I've got fae hearing, mm-hmm. or I'm so glad for these things. Now, that doesn't mean she's not proud of being human. But there's got to be some level of resentment sometimes.
I don't see her being completely proud of being human. I mean, her saying, like, I've never not been proud of it. I don't believe that. What I read into this is I've never been traumatized by my human side.
Mm.
Like, she's never not been proud of her mom, of her, Randall.
Yeah.
Versus she's only ever been disappointed by the Autumn King and Rune.
Yeah. No, it's a great point.
Thank you. Bryce, we'll talk about this in therapy.
I love that point because she's not looking internally, she's looking externally.
Mm-hmm.
She is proud of the humans in her life,
yeah.
Where she's not so proud of the phase in her life.
Yep.
Great point.
Thank you. Let's take a moment to appreciate that Bryce's father, quote, called me a worthless disgrace, stormed out. By the time I caught out, he'd taken the car and left. When I got back to his house, I found my bags on the curb. She's 13. He said that to her at 13. And the only reason why she got out of there is because she was able to, is because Rune gave her cash.
Yeah.
The Autumn King forbade Rune of helping her.
Yeah.
She's 13. Why is he so upset? Now, you and I are convinced that the Autumn King's going to have a bigger role in book 3. Now, once again, this season, like, we haven't read book 3 yet. It hasn't come out in recording.
So freaking close.
We're so close. But there's something about the Autumn King that I find to be very interesting, because I feel like Bryce and Autumn King are compared so much by Rune. And we've seen that several times in this book already, where Rune says, like, God, Bryce reminded me so much of our father, of the Autumn King. He never says our father, Autumn King. And then when I was rereading Hosab, he says that so many times.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, what's happening here? Like, there's a clear parallel.
Right.
And Bryce is so good. And again, I feel like the Autumn King has done enough shit that we can guess that he's not good.
Yeah.
But that kind of reaction is so intense that it's like, there's got to be something more.
Well, think about it this way. Rune has already seen the Oracle. Mm-hmm. And his prophecy that he told his father was really lackluster. Like, he'll be a fair and just king.
Yeah.
Well, the Autumn King was disappointed because it wasn't greater.
Mm-hmm.
And now he has this child who the Oracle has it out for her because she went blind for a week because...
Yeah, but wouldn't he assume special?
No.
Like, and that's no. But, I mean, I'd be like, good job, honey. You scarred her.
I think whatever his motivations are, whatever his agenda is that's going on behind the scenes, I think he was relying on one or two of his children to help further it, and their prophecies don't align with what he needs from them.
So what I'm hearing there is that there's a specific thing he needs to hear.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, and that's the thing that he's doing behind the scenes, right, where it's like, there's a thing that he's not hearing, but yeah. God, I want book 3. Apparently, there's been tons of grocery stores that have accidentally put out CC3. And people have been buying them. Yeah. I wouldn't know what to do.
I would buy it if I saw it.
You would really read it?
Absolutely. I wouldn't tell anyone anything.
Could you tell me?
I would give it to you to read after it was done.
And then you'd be like, you'd give it to me with big eyes. Like, yeah. So we might stop by Ralph's.
Okay. During their research, Bryce and Hunt talk about Parthos, and Hunt does not take Bryce seriously for believing in Parthos. And I don't like it. But I will leave my discussion for Parthos in the breadcrumbs because it is very spoilery.
Mm.
Hunt, having not taken Bryce seriously about Parthos, now also doesn't take Bryce seriously when he lets her know they're going to see Philip Briggs and she says she's ready. And I wonder, does he actually have a right to push back? Because Bryce pushes back at his pushback and she's pissed.
Yeah, she's pissed. I mean, he also kind of set her up to be pissed because she was saying, like, what? Humans weren't too busy being essentially a caveman to be able to have such intellect and stuff.
Yeah.
And spoiler for book 2, Hosab, and I feel like it's important to talk about it here, is that, like, this is such a clear moment of, in book two, Bryce doesn't tell Hunt about finding Emil.
Yeah.
And she says, you don't understand humans. You don't have compassion for humans.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is that moment.
Yeah.
Where when I was listening to that, it's funny because I was like, I finished that book and then I was like, interesting. I'm like, I don't really agree. Like, I feel like you're too harsh on him. And then immediately read this. And I was like, Bryce.
Well, I think what it is even though sometimes there's Hunt able to make those empathetic connections, like when thinking about Pangaea and the cities being pens for humans, he's able to make that connection. But I think he is a product of his environment, and he's a product of propaganda, of misinformation, and whatever narrative the Asteri have been spinning, because what else could there possibly be?
Yeah, you and I talk a lot about, in writing, inherent biases, and how authors really have to dig deep to say, okay, there's, you know, I'm not hateful, I'm not racist, I'm not all these things, but I was brought up in a society that is, and I have to make a conscious effort and recognize and humble myself to see when it's happening in my own writing without realizing it.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the similar thing that's happening here with Hunt, where there are those inherent biases of humans, where he has empathy, he doesn't hate humans, but he lives in a world that does.
Yeah.
And he hasn't done the work yet.
Right. After Bryce sends Hunt away so that she can collect herself, Lahaba tries to convince Bryce that Bryce needs friends, and Bryce doesn't want to hear it. When Bryce pushes Lahaba away, Lahaba says, quote, "You can be as cold as a reaper, Bryce." And I really hope that's just a turn of phrase. What I like about the scene, though, as much as it hurts me, is that we get to see a parallel between Bryce and Hunt in this moment. Hunt had to use scalding showers to punish himself for being the Umbra Mortis and piece himself back together. Bryce, on the other hand, has to isolate herself and push those she cares about and those that care about her away. Like, think about her mom. She's constantly pushing her mother away in order to punish herself because her friends are dead and she's alive.
Yeah.
Right. And essentially, they're doing the same thing. They're punishing themselves and perpetuating cycles. She mistakenly believes that isolation will help her piece herself back together, just like Hunt mistakenly believes a scalding shower will help him put himself back together.
Yeah. This section, I feel like, doesn't get enough credit by no one because we haven't talked to anyone, but... You know, Lahaba drops some really intense truth bombs here. And I feel like we're not giving Lahaba enough credit of seeing things that Bryce doesn't see. You know, she talks about, like, hey, Fury's gone. You don't talk to Juniper. You need friends. But the most important thing I want to point out here is, quote, "Hunt is nice. Prince Rune is nice. But Danica was never nice to me. Always biting and snarling, or she ignored me. Watch it," said Bryce. The important point here is that Danica was not nice. And I'm going to really drive that point home later. And I don't even think book one or two that Bryce ever had that moment of Danica was not a good person.
Right. And we talked about it in episode one that Danica's an alpha hole.
Yeah.
And she was the only alpha hole that Bryce could accept in her life. And this, for me, when Lahaba's like, Danica was never nice to me, is the first crack in the Danica memory, where Lahaba's throwing a rock at Bryce's image of Danica, then Briggs is going to throw a rock, and it's just going to compound over and over until it shatters.
And it's really messy because the rocks, I mean, like, this rock, I feel like, is a true rock of, like, Danica wasn't nice.
Yeah.
And again, if Danica was a good person, Bryce wouldn't have sold her soul to save her.
Yeah.
Because it's like, okay, you've done shit, but at least you were always good at heart.
Yeah.
That's not what she said.
Right.
She sold her soul. But what Briggs does, what other people do, there's always that hint of, like, but she cared about the humans. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I don't know if we'll ever get that full shattering of Danica that I feel like she deserves, because...
I suspect we might, because Bryce is close to her wit's end in Sky and Breath.
Yeah.
With all the lies that she keeps uncovering that Danica hid.
Lies that she didn't. I mean, we'll get into it when we talk about Sky and Breath, but, like, not necessary lies.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And I think there's got to be a reckoning in Bryce's own brain mm-hmm. about Danica. She's got to make peace with it because she's not at peace with it right now.
You're right. I mean, it's such a big theme in book one. We're going to see it be a huge theme in book two. I can't imagine that suddenly stopping in book three.
Yeah, agree.
Thank you for listening to part one of this week's episode of Book Talk for Book Talk. We encourage you to rate and subscribe to our show on your preferred podcast listening platform. Tune in Thursday for part two, where we finish covering this week's chapters.
We would love to hear your thoughts based on today's conversation. You can submit your comments to our form at booktalkforbooktalk.com for a chance to have your feedback discussed during a future mini episode.
If you're enjoying the podcast, please visit our website, booktalkforbooktalk.com, to view our latest merch and learn about supporting the show through Patreon, Ko-Fi, or Venmo.
Bye.